Hello and welcome to episode 8 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast, Rio Rita. And I would like to take this opportunity. It is my great honor and pleasure to introduce author, musician, playwright, director, actor, a man who, when he hikes through the Swiss Alps, people yell, Nicola, Nick Santa Maria.
You would compare me to a lozenge.
Well, you're very soothing.
Yeah, that's true. You know, actually, someone told me that recently, that they thought I had a very soothing voice.
Yeah.
And I had to tell them that, you know, I've done over 250 audiobooks. And when I can't sleep, I could put in one of my audiobooks, turn it down low, and I will put me to sleep faster than any politician or any physics teacher that I've ever had. So,
yeah, I've only done 150 titles, so you're ahead of me.
Oh, okay. Well, you do have a good speaking voice, and I know you have radio experience. And
yeah, this is all in spite of the fact that I grew up in Boston.
You know, Boston, I played Boston a few times, you know, and when you play a big city, you stay usually for more than a week, you know, when you're with a Broadway tour. And Boston is the one city that I was in long enough to get to know, but never got to know. It just seemed like there were so many different areas and so many different things to see that I never really pinpointed it. I still can't think of it. Faneuil Hall is the closest.
Yep.
I come to what I remember, and little cemeteries along the way.
Yes.
Walking down roads, which I like.
Yes.
Yeah. But anyway, Boston's a good city.
Yeah.
I liked it. Good audiences. So anyway, we are discussing a very interesting turn in Abbott and Costello's career. And we're going to be discussing that and how this all came about. But first, I want to talk about Florence Ziegfeld, because this movie is a remake of a film made in 1929. Now, this is 1942. This is a remake of a film made in 1929 based on a Ziegfeld show from 1927. Now, let's start at the beginning. Where was Lou Costello born?
Patterson, New Jersey.
Everybody say it with me. But 11 years earlier, another great vaudeville comedian was born in Patterson, New Jersey, but more in the Irish neighborhood. And that was Burt Wheeler of Wheeler and Woolsey. Mm-hmm. Now, Burt Wheeler was a vaudevillian with his wife. They were Burt and Betty Wheeler. They were big stars in vaudeville. Eventually, Ziegfeld came knocking, and apparently Burt was a very big hit in the Ziegfeld Follies. I think it might have been 1923. I forget what it is. And eventually his wife leaves him for a dancer and a dance act, and the rest is obscurity for her. And Burt goes on as a single. Now, Ziegfeld loves Burt and decides to make him the comedy star of his next book show. Now, not a review, not the Ziegfeld Follies. This was a book show, beginning, middle, and end. Songs that move the story along. Everybody thinks that Oklahoma was the first to do that in the 1940s. Yep. But no, it was actually Showboat, which was Ziegfeld. So this was called Rio Rita. And it's the story of a bandit, a Mexican bandit called the Kinkajou. And the Kinkajou was a deadly bandit, and it was all about finding out who it was and blah, 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 blah. And Wheeler, Burt Wheeler, plays Chick Bean, who is set to, who marries, actually, someone. But they find out that it's illegal somehow. And the lawyer is his partner, Robert Woolsey of Wheeler and Woolsey. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the Broadway play was a huge hit, and it ran for a couple of years. But Woolsey only did it for about 9 months, and then he went off to do something else.
Oh.
Now, I have to go back. I'm sorry. Stay with me, folks, because this is very interesting. Robert Woolsey, born in 1888, I believe, in Oakland, California. Might have been Illinois, but we're not sure. But anyway, he started out as a jockey. He hurt himself. He decided to go into show business. And he started on a series of stock companies that he joined and would go around the country doing various shows, different shows. And in one of these stock companies was a comedian, a star comedian by the name of Walter Catlett. Now, old movie fans will know him. He was a constant presence, a very funny gentleman, wore horn-rimmed glasses, had a big cigar, very blustery, you know, and the character was very popular. So coincidentally, Ziegfeld called and wanted Walter Catlett for his next Follies. So he got to leave the stock company, and that left Robert Woolsey. And Woolsey asked him if he could use the character that he created. And this actually exists. Walter Catlett put it in writing in a letter saying, sure, go ahead. It's yours. Have fun. Robert Woolsey made a career out of imitating Walter Catlett for the rest of his life. Now, here's the really interesting part of this.
Ooh.
When Robert Woolsey left Rio Rita after 9 months, Walter Catlett replaced him and stayed even longer than Robert Woolsey did with the show. But then he left. Robert Woolsey came back for a short period and, you know, to close the show. And when RKO said, we're going to make a movie out of this, they chose Burt Wheeler and Robert Woolsey rather than Walter Catlett. So they were just a hair's breadth away from being, you know, Wheeler and Catlett or Catlett.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
So they go to Hollywood and they make a Rio Rita, which is the only the second sound film that RKO makes. The first one is Synchronicity, something like that. It's my buddy Dorothy Lee is in it. But anyway, so the movie is a huge hit. It's the biggest hit RKO has until King Kong 4 years later.
Wow.
Yeah, biggie. It's a biggie. So yeah, the leads are John Bowles, who, you know, makes me a little nauseous. He's a little bit of a, hello there, you know. that's how I describe all those guys, you know.
Yeah.
And Bebe Daniels is the leading lady. And another slightly interesting thing was the first time I ever saw this movie was at the Vagabond Theater in Los Angeles in 1979. And it was packed. The theater was absolutely packed to the rafters. And I found myself sitting next to this old man, and I'll say he was flamboyant. He was in the costume department when they made the film that we were watching. And as we were watching it, he was telling me things or making comments about, you know, Bebe Daniels' saggy boobs and all that stuff. Seriously, that was one of the things he said.
Wow.
But yeah, it was pretty interesting. But anyway, the film Rio Rita was a huge hit, and I still think it's the best material Wheeler and Woolsey ever had. And that's that. So the movie's made. Now, fast forward. Here we are. We're up to 1942. Abbott and Costello are making hit after hit after hit at Universal Studios. They are exhausted. They are on their sixth movie, I think, was Ride 'Em Cowboy. Yeah.
Yep.
Imagine. And they started, you know, in 1940. So they were absolutely knackered, as the British say. So back when they first got offers from movie studios, MGM was the first. MGM said, we want you guys to guest star in our film Ziegfeld Girl. But that wasn't enough for them, and that's why they went with Universal. But MGM was angry, and you did not get the lion angry. And all the studios knew this. The MGM was the most prestigious studio in the world, not just in the country, in the world. So you did not piss off Louis B. Mayer. And to mollify MGM at this point, Universal said, you could have our boys for one movie a year. And this is the first movie they contracted at MGM, Rio Rita, a remake of the 1929 Wheeler and Woolsey film, Rio Rita. Now, it's been significantly changed to go along with the, you know, modern times. And instead of the Kinkajou, we now have a covey of Nazis. Would you say a covey?
I would call them something much worse than that. But yes, that works.
A murder of Nazis.
Ooh, yes.
Yeah. Nasty, naughty Nazis.
pointy teeth.
We meet them. So yeah, the Nazis are our villains, and they're great. They make great villains. They still make great villains.
Yes.
So I looked into the writers of this film. You know, this is something mm-hmm. new. MGM, you know, known as the comedy killers amongst classic comedy fans. And I'll get into that in a minute. Two names I didn't recognize in the world of Abbott and Costello were Gladys Lehman and Richard Connell. They wrote the movie. They wrote the screenplay, let's say. And they were so unlikely. Richard Connell was a classic short story writer. He was the editor of the Harvard Lampoon when he was going to Harvard. He wrote one of my favorite short stories, which turned into one of my favorite movies, The Most Dangerous Game. He's writing Rio Rita.
Oh my gosh. The guy who wrote Most Dangerous Game wrote for Abbott and Costello. Oh my gosh.
Oh my God.
All of a sudden I see Abbott and Costello doing The Most Dangerous Game, and that's not a pleasant picture. No.
With Mr. Fields running after them.
Yes.
Or Mike the Cop.
Anyway.
So anyway, yeah, but I thought that was pretty interesting. Richard Connell and Gladys Lehman also. She was one of the founders of the Writers Guild, Screenwriters Guild. She also was one of the founders of the Motion Picture Fund, you know, which is one of the most amazing organizations in Hollywood.
Yeah.
So these are like really class people. And together they were nominated for an Oscar for another MGM comedy, Two Girls and a Sailor, it was called.
Oh.
That was with Jimmy Durante and Gloria DeHaven and June Allison and Harry James and whatever. So they have credentials, and I'm sure, bear me out on this because I know you watched it recently. I have a feeling that they just wrote the not Abbott and Costello story. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right?
John
Grant gets a special credit here. Special material for Abbott and Costello by John Grant. And thank God he was there. I'm telling you. We talked a lot about the songs in the Abbott and Costello films. And I know I'm a big fan of that period. But there were only two songs I could sit through in this movie. And they're both from the 1929 production, and that's the original Rio Rita. Rio Rita, la da da da. I thought of you, Jerry, because it was "Life is sweeter, Rita, when you're near. Life's completer, Rita." I thought you would get into that.
Oh
and
yeah,
the other one is the Ranger song. With a good house together.
Yep.
That's a lot of fun. And I love that Lou keeps requesting it on the radio. So anyway, we're at MGM, and it must have been quite exciting for Lou Costello, who was there about 15 years earlier, trying to make it and going home with his tail between his legs, now returning as possibly one of the biggest stars in the world.
Yeah.
Box office stars. It must have been something.
Yep. About Hail the Conquering Hero. My goodness.
Yeah, really. Really.
Yeah.
I can tell you the boys had weird feelings about MGM. They didn't think Universal ever treated them fairly. I will say that. They made more money than anybody, and they were constantly asking for color, you know, Technicolor, better casts, you know. But now they were at MGM, and they didn't have the color, but it's decidedly more expensive looking.
Yes.
Definitely. All three of the movies they made there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that MGM look.
Gloss.
I've yet to be able to put my finger on exactly what caused it, what it is, but it is a thing. It's that MGM gloss, I guess, is the best way to say it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And if you put your finger on it, you would smudge that gloss. You know?
Probably. Not a good idea.
Yeah, no. You'd have to be careful about things like that because you never know. Anyway, we like to pass on these little pieces of advice to our listeners. And that's just one of them. So anyway, this movie, it opens up. It's directed by S. Sylvan Simon, who is MGM's comedy expert at the moment. He was responsible for Red Skelton's funniest films there, meaning his Whistling series, Whistling in the Dark, Whistling in Dixie, and Whistling in Brooklyn, where Red plays the fox, the radio's fox. But yeah, S. Sylvan Simon was a very, very good director. He also directed The Boys in their Abbott and Costello in Hollywood, I believe it was. Was it Hollywood?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Father's Son Hollywood. I think so, yeah.
Yes. And so he's got, you know, credentials. He's responsible for The Fuller Brush Man, which is probably my favorite Red Skelton movie. And he also, and this is trivia that I just learned yesterday, if you're a fan of the Marx Brothers' The Big Store, which I happen to be,
yes,
I'm also a fan of the dreaded roller skate chase at the end. I just think it's beautiful.
Yes.
S. Sylvan Simon, uncredited, worked on The Chase.
For
The Big Store. So that kind of makes sense. And this movie, Rio Rita, has some of those, what I call The Big Store special effects, meaning people flying around on wires and stuff like that, you know, fast motion, slide whistles, you know. That was a phenomenon of the late 30s into the 40s. So anyway, so the opening scene, here's another piece of trivia you may not know. The opening scene takes place in a pet shop. And I love the opening shot. It's the front window. And in the front window is a fake dog, you know, in a street scene. And it's like a setup, you know, what a, what do they call them? Window dressers. What
window
a window
dresser, yeah.
Setup. So Bud comes by and he puts a fire hydrant next to the dog and salutes it like a, you're welcome. And walks away. It's very subtle, you know.
Yep.
In fact, it took me a few viewings to actually get that or see that. But anyway, here's the trivia involved. This scene was shot after the movie was finished.
Oh.
So here's what happened. They shot an entire opening song with Catherine Grayson.
Okay. Of course.
Thank God they made this decision, I'm telling you. But it was a, you know, a big production number filled with stereotypical Mexican citizens. You know, all that stuff.
Yep.
And they got word from the Latin American governments saying, we're tired of being depicted that way. And we would really appreciate it if, number one, you moved the story from Mexico to Texas, which they did, and you would treat our people a little more fairly, you know, whatever. So the song was already shot and they had to scrap it.
Wow.
And they went back. John Grant wrote them that beautiful opening scene, one of my favorite opening scenes in any Abbott and Costello movie, and actually saved the day. So it's almost like what happened with A Night at the Opera. That was the same situation, only with Italians. They were tired of, you know, being depicted the way they were depicted. So anyway, so that's the first interesting bit of trivia.
And so as a result, this Abbott and Costello movie actually opens with Abbott and Costello.
Yes.
What a genius idea that is.
How about that? And they had to go to MGM.
Yeah.
Which reminds me, if you are a classic comedy fan, and if you're listening to this, you probably lean that way. MGM is considered the comedy killer. Now, what I mean by that is they came up with the great idea of teaming Buster Keaton with Jimmy Durante. They tried to make a star out of Jack Pearl, Baron Munchausen, and failed miserably. They didn't come up with one classic Red Skelton film in 15 years.
Yeah.
They were good distributors. I mean, they distributed Hal Roach's product for a good long time. But as far as producing lowbrow comedy, it was not their forte. I mean, let's face it, they opened up the Marx Brothers for women by having Harpo get beat up by villains. This was MGM, you know, they humanized these people, they made them formulaic. And I would say that their worst offense, Jerry, and so tell me if you agree, our gang, the Little Rascals.
Oh. What yes.
They did, what they did to those kids and those movies, it's horrifying.
We'll never be bad boys again.
Dun, 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 dun. Oh, my God.
Oh, yes.
It's difficult to watch. So Bud and Lou are there in the place where comedy is killed, where it goes to die. And I have to say that this movie is so interesting to me because, number one, Bud looks great. Bud's in that pinstripe suit with a great hairpiece, and he just looks slick. He looks great.
Yep.
And he's on board 100%. That's for sure. He even gets a girl in this one.
Yes.
We never really know who she is, but he makes out with her in the back of the taxi cab. You know, that's a plus for Bud.
Yeah.
And Lou, and I don't know if you can credit this to the director. I'm thinking yes, because this is a director they haven't encountered. They've used Arthur Lubin for their last like five films. So S. Sylvan Simon might have told Lou, you know, you might want to make it a little more natural, you know, rather than yelling everything or screaming or whatever. Because Lou, his delivery vacillates between that high-pitched, you know, Lou's frustrated, and this very subtle way of telling a joke. Mm-hmm. And it really helps. And it helps with the timing between the two of them. And it's really fascinating to me. There's a scene in the movie where they have to get into an empty office. They're starving. You know, they haven't eaten in days. And they have to get into this office. They see a box of apples. They do this dialogue outside the window. And we're going to play it for you now. But see if you can see the difference in Lou's delivery and timing. You'll see. You'll see. It's very obvious where it comes in.
Hey, Doctor, what? I'm awful hungry. I ain't eaten in 2 days.
Wait a minute. Here's a window.
What's that got to do with it?
Well, look in there and see if there's any food. Take it easy.
Oh! Look!
What? Apples. Big one. Just the size of them.
Woo!
They must be hothouse apples.
What's a hothouse?
That's a greenhouse.
What's a greenhouse?
Well, a greenhouse is a building painted white.
How could it be a greenhouse if it's painted white?
Well, a greenhouse could be painted red and still be a greenhouse.
Somebody colorblind?
All right, well, look, go ahead and get the apples. Come on.
Okay, give me a boost. Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, come on.
Wait a minute.
What's the matter?
Suppose somebody comes in.
What are you worrying about? You don't want them to catch me, do you?
No.
All right, go ahead, get in.
But they'll catch me.
Well, you're little. You're small. You don't mind that.
I'm sorry. I have a ticket upstairs.
Go ahead, get in. Come on now.
Go ahead. Way up. Way up.
Hey,
Make it. Get out of here.
What's the matter?
What's the matter?
Why did you push me so fast for? Well, you were just in there. Why didn't you get the apples?
What did I get inside? Didn't give me a boost.
You were in there.
Who was in there?
You.
I was. Same room.
Come on, get in.
What's the matter?
Get up.
Go ahead.
Hey, come on, hurry up. Get the apples, hurry up.
Yeah.
Get the whole box.
Come on.
Get the whole box. Hurry up.
Okay, so you see that's different for Lou. And there's another scene coming up where we'll get to that. But interestingly, from the pet store, which is run by Joe Kirk, who played Mr. Bacigalup in the Abbott and Costello TV show, and who was also, he had just married Lou's sister, Marie, and he appears in every Abbott and Costello movie up until the time he divorced Lou's sister, Marie. that was about, I guess, about 10 years later or so. But boy, he got a nice career out of marrying sister Marie. So, they do some great stuff here. In fact, we've got to play some of these jokes. This is one of my favorite scenes.
Hey, Doc, what? Why did we ever take this job in the first place?
Because we're stranded in this town.
Because we're stranded here.
It's nice enough of this fellow to give us a job here.
Yeah.
He promised us eating money for tonight. Huh? And if we stay here long enough, maybe we'll have enough money to go back to New York.
Who wants to go to New York? I want to go to Brooklyn.
All right, you go to Brooklyn. I'll go to New York.
Okay.
What are you eating those dog biscuits for?
Well, they're good. I like them.
Never mind. Leave them alone.
Okay, so you go to New York. I'll go to Brooklyn.
All right.
Answer the phone.
It didn't ring?
Why wait till the last minute? Put those down.
Hello? Yes? Yes, Mrs. Pike. Yes, we bathe, feed, and exercise dogs. Shirley, what kind of a dog have you got, Mrs. Pike? A Pekingese? All right, goodbye. Hey, Wishy. Go over and get a peek at Mrs. Pike's.
Get a peek at Mrs. Pike's?
Yes.
Why can't I take a good look?
Go over and get Pike's peek.
Get Pike's peek? What am I, a mountain climber?
Go over to Mrs. Pike's house. You'll see her peek around the yard.
I'll see her peek around the yard?
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to do, play hide and seek with the girl?
Listen.
Oh, I mean, after all, the boss told me to get busy with that white dog. You know, he wants me to watch.
What white dog?
The white one. What do you call it? The
Spitz?
No, but he drools a little. I'm there. Hiya, boss.
Hiya, boss.
We're very busy.
How's Mrs. Brown's chow?
I don't know. I never ate up at the lady's house.
What do you use me for?
It's a dog you took out for a walk.
Oh, the last time I saw that thing, it was walking down the street. It was going to court.
How do you know he was going to court?
He had a policeman in his mouth.
Didn't I tell you not to take that dog out without a muzzle on?
I put a muzzle on, but I couldn't breathe through it.
I told you what would happen if you lost one of the dogs.
Look, boss, give me another chance. I'm sorry. Look, I'll get him another dog. I'll get him a bird dog.
She hasn't any bird.
I'll fit him in a boot, boss. I'll get her a sled dog.
She hasn't any sled.
Well, then I'll get him a bloodhound. Let her try to get out of that one.
Get out of here, both of you. You're fired.
Okay,
so they get thrown out of the pet store for being totally inept. And Bud wants to get back to New York. Lou, on the other hand, wants to get back to Brooklyn. They step outside and they see a car, and the car has a New York license plate. And since it's pointing east, they assume that it's going to New York. So they get into the trunk of the car, the two of them, close the trunk, not even thinking of the fact that they were probably 1,500 miles away from New York and would have suffocated long before they arrived. But they assumed it was going to New York, but it wasn't. This is the car of Ricardo Montero, who is a radio star. He's a singer. He comes from that Texas town that they're going to. And the place he's going to is called Vista del Rio. And I can only think of Jerry Seinfeld's parents when I
hear the name of that. Oh, my goodness.
Vista del Rio. Yeah.
I had not made that connection. Yes. Oh, my goodness.
of Frank Costanza. Yeah. You won't let us into Vista del Rio? Oh, God. But anyway, it's owned, or it was left to Catherine Grayson, who is Rita of the Rio. It's really weird. He sings a love song to her, the Rio Rita. That means Rita River.
That's her last name, you know.
It could be. Or maybe he's just going with the flow or with the tide or whatever. No, I shouldn't do product placement. No, I take back
that. No.
Side remark. Okay.
Okay.
They get into the car and Ricardo drives to Del Boca Vista, and he tells the staff once he gets there that he hears some strange noises in the back of his car, and could they recommend a mechanic? So he's the big star, so they take the car to the mechanic, blah blah blah. And Rita and Ricardo are reunited. They knew each other as children and are now seeing each other for the first time in years. She has an incredible crush on him, and he's kind of interested too. Now, we're talking about John Carroll, who has just come off the Marx Brothers' absolute worst film. Go West, which is where their careers went when they made that. But anyway, he was the leading man in that. And you know, John Carroll's not a bad leading man, I have to say. He's rugged. He's, you know, he's good. And he has a good fake Mexican accent in this.
Yeah.
So yeah, they have their little moment of tension. And then there's a third party who comes in. That's Lucette, who sets her eyes on John Carroll. And she's played by Pat Dane, a starlet that MGM put some juice behind, but it didn't really work. And she went back to Florida, where she was from, and lived out the rest of her life. But she's very good in this film, I have to say. So anyway, that's all set up. There's a little triangle going on there. Catherine Grayson and Rita is very jealous and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so Abbott and Costello are at the mechanics in the trunk. Now, let's talk about this mechanic and where it is situated.
I don't know who designed this service station, but...
I think it was Evel Knievel. or King Kong. It's on the precipice of a cliff. It looks like a bottomless pit, you know? And it's right on the edge of this bottomless pit. So they send the car up on the rack, and they turn it at an angle where when the boys get out of the trunk, they are facing the abyss. And what happens is there's this terrific big store special effects a sequence where the car just goes crazy. Bud gets off and he's trying to get Lou down, and it starts spinning at top speed, and they fly onto the roof and all this stuff. It's a really good slapstick sequence.
I got to tell you, my favorite visual gag from this whole movie happens in this scene. And we're doing a podcast, so I have to explain the visual gag. Mm-hmm. Lou's still up there and Bud's down with the controls trying to stop it, and it's spinning and spinning. Mm-hmm. And so you see Lou, and his hat flies off his head off to the right. And then seconds later, it flies back in from the left and hits him in the face.
That's my favorite moment, too.
I have two, actually. Two where I laugh out loud. That's one. And the other one is when he's losing his pants.
You know, yes,
he's
hanging from the
car. To the fender. And the worst thing that could possibly happen. He starts losing his pants. The other thing I liked is when Bud's on the roof. Bud ends up on the roof of the gas station and is asking Lou to help him down. And the first thing Lou does is take off his little hat and say, "Here, jump in the hat. Jump in the hat." But the method he uses, he throws a hose up there or something. And he says, "Here, hold on to that." Right. And Bud holds on to it. And Lou just pulls him off. And he falls flat on his face. Well, that begins. See what MGM is causing, this laughter.
Yes.
But anyway, they are chased by two of the Nazis. Now, I should explain this. The manager of Del Boca Vista is Tom Conway, and he is George Sanders' younger brother. Mm-hmm. And he's had a very busy few years, including this movie, but he had mm-hmm. taken over as the Falcon in the Falcon series at RKO.
Oh.
Took over for his brother. In fact, there's a movie, The Falcon's Brother, where George Sanders is actually killed and Tom Conway takes over.
Missed that one. Okay.
Oh, it's good. It's really good. So anyway, he was doing that. He was doing films for Val Lewton, the great horror producer at RKO. Mm-hmm. And he was doing outside work as well at MGM. He was under contract at RKO. And by the way, the Abbott and Costello deal here at Universal, they got a percentage, a big percentage. MGM didn't give percentages to anybody.
Yeah.
So, but what they got was, usually when stars were loaned to a studio, the studio would keep most of the salary that the stars were getting, and the stars would only get what they would usually get at their studio. So what MGM did was, rather than give Abbott and Costello lesser money, they gave him the exact same money that they gave to Universal. So they both made 70 grand in this film, but no percentage. Okay, so this starts a great chase. I mean, this is so much fun with the boys. This is one of those scenes where they're sitting by the bench and they're talking about starving. And Bud tells him, you know, if you're heavy, you starve much faster than a thin person does, you know, or whatever. But it's really, again, I'd love to play this dialogue for the people, because, again, I just love the delivery of this.
Hey, Doc, how long does it take a person to die of starvation?
What good would it do if you knew?
I'm planning my future.
Well, offhand, I'd say that all depends on what you are.
I'm a boy.
Well, that makes no difference whether you're a boy or a girl.
I know, but it does to me.
No, what I mean is that a fat person starves faster than a thin person.
I'm hungry, too.
I know that. Well, I'm a thin person, and I haven't had food for 2 days, and I still have the face of a 10-year-old boy.
If I was you, I'd give it back to him, because you're getting it all wrinkled.
Now, wait a minute. We're talking about you.
Hmm. Let's put it this way. Suppose you were dying of starvation.
You got a certain look in your eyes.
Slow.
Oh.
Come here. You're slow dying of starvation.
Hey, Doc. How about...
I likened Lou, my favorite Nazi... It sounds like a Bob Hope movie. Played by Dorothy Lamour, you know.
With Sig Ruman, yeah.
Sig Ruman.
Yes.
He's made this reputation.
Peter Whitney plays Jake, and he's the big, mm-hmm. dumb Nazi. And he's the one that goes up against Lou more often than not. And Lou is constantly running into his chest, because that's where he comes up to. Yeah. like he's a wall, you know. But it reminds me of Bugs Bunny and whoever he's, you know, torturing at the moment.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. It's you know, running, and then, you know, Lou is sitting down watching the guys run around in a circle, and then he stops and says, no, the big guy was first, you know, and Wait a minute. Who's chasing who? But the best gag to me is the table full of Margaret Dumont's.
Yes.
Lou is being chased, and there is a big banquet going on. There's food everywhere, but there is this long table with about 20 older women, all Margaret Dumont-like. You know what I'm saying? Ooh, duh. And Lou crawls under the table and goes the length of the table underneath. You don't see him. You just hear the ladies go, ooh, 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 until he gets to the end. And then he comes back, and they not only go, ooh, ooh, but they jump up, you know, at each turn. And it's a great gag. It's a great gag. And I know it's an old one. It's probably, you know, Max Sennett. But it doesn't matter. It works really, really well. So, okay. So Catherine Grayson, Rita, shows her good side and that we should be rooting for her. When she overhears Bud and Lou talking about being hungry, she tells the waiters to set up a table for them. Not with the real people, but outside, away from the respective people.
Separate but equal, yes.
Separate but equal, yes. So they're just so excited to be eating, and Lou spends this entire scene with his mouth full. It's a little disgusting, but still, it's Lou. So here is where they do, I think, the oldest joke. And now Bud and Lou were known for using material that was 10 times older than they were.
Yeah.
But this may be the oldest joke they ever did. And I know it's an old minstrel joke. And they're looking at the roasted chicken and they're salivating.
Doc, look, food. I can't bear it.
Ham, lamb, lobster, cake.
Cut it out, you're killing me.
Pie.
Don't let me.
Hey, and a great big chicken. Wolf, I only had that chicken.
Me too. Hey, if you had the chicken, could I have the two legs?
No, I want the two legs.
Could I have the two wings?
I want the wings.
Or could I have the breast and the neck?
I want the legs, I want the wings, I want the breast, I want the neck.
All right, go ahead. I'll sit on a fence and catch mine as it goes by.
Oh, come on.
I'll catch mine as he goes by. I mean, how desperate did they have to be to do that joke, to go back, you know, to Lincoln, to John Wilkes Booth, you know? Yeah. He probably enjoyed it with his fellow assassin. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I just find it very interesting. Even when I was a kid, or when I first saw this film, I wasn't a kid, I was in my teens, that joke stood out like a sore thumb. I knew immediately where it came from. So then they do one of their famous bits, a bit they don't do again until Noose Hangs High about five years later, or 6 years later. It's "You're Not Here." I'll bet you you're not here. Now, you know the premise to this thing.
I'll bet you you're not here. How much you want to bet? All right, we bet the chickens.
No, but the chicken?
We'll bet the chickens. Don't touch them.
Yeah.
Bet my chicken against your chicken.
My chicken against your chicken? I'm here.
You're not here.
I'm here.
All right, you're not in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
You're not in Baltimore. And you're not in Washington.
I got an aunt lives here.
Never mind that. Well, if you're not in Philadelphia, Baltimore, or Washington, you must be someplace else.
That's right.
And if you're someplace else, you can't be here, can you?
No.
All right. Come here. Wait a minute. What are you taking my chicken for?
Who took your chicken?
You just took my chicken.
I took your chicken?
Yes.
Get out of here.
Now, wait a minute.
I didn't take your chicken.
Be fair.
Didn't you say I was in Baltimore?
Yes.
I was in Washington?
Yes.
I was in Philadelphia?
That's what I told you.
Well, if I'm not in Baltimore, Philadelphia, Washington, I must be someplace else.
You must be someplace else.
Oh, if I'm someplace else, I can't be here.
That's what I said.
Oh, if I'm not here, how could I have your chickens?
Come on, give me my chicken.
No, you lost them, Barry.
Give me my chicken.
So that's, you know, that's one of their standbys. That's one of their, they do it with Mike Mazurki in Noose Hangs High. It's really sweet. It's really well done.
I love Mike Mazurki.
How can you not love Mike Mazurki?
I know.
I'm looking for Velma. I love him in the Bowery Boys' first film, Live Wires. And he spoofs his role in Murder, My Sweet.
Oh.
And he's hilarious. He's just hilarious. Yeah, he's great. He's great. Okay, so the first song is written by, here's some more trivia. The song "Long Before You Came Along," I think it's called. Yeah, "Long Before You Came Along." It was written by E.Y. Yip Harburg and Harold Arlen, who just a couple of years earlier wrote the Wizard of Oz score, and Lydia the Tattooed Lady, among many other things. So they wrote that one song. They were hoping that was going to be the hit, and it wasn't. It was it was more like the miss. So so the song didn't quite make it, and I don't know about you, Jerry, but I could take Jeanette McDonald. You know, I could listen to her depending on the on the song. I have a little trouble with Catherine Grayson. She's a little too piercing for me.
Yes,
maybe that's it. I don't know.
Well, to me, the thing that gets me about Catherine Grayson is I really enjoy her acting. And the singing just seems a little out of step with what I've just watched. And now she's singing, her style just, they don't click together.
It seems like a really modern woman. And then all of a sudden, but I also have a thing. I met her once at an autograph show.
Oh.
And I was so excited to meet her because my mom, when she was a kid, not a kid, but, you know, when she was a woman, a young woman, she kind of resembled Catherine Grayson, complete with the turned up nose, the whole bit. And I maybe stupidly, maybe foolishly said, "Hi, it's such a pleasure to meet you. You know, my mom was always compared to you looks wise when she was younger," and da 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 da. And she just barely looked at me and went, "Really?" If she had like a water balloon, she would have thrown it at me. she wasn't very pleased. But, you know, I got to meet someone in the Abbott and Costello movie we're talking about. All right. So she sings the cockamamie song. We figure out that Ricardo and she have a thing, and the Nazis, here's their plan. I mentioned the apples earlier.
Yes.
They ordered a bunch of these apples, fake apples. But what they are is if you pull the stem up, they're radio receivers, right? They play radio and they receive. So what they were going to do was give it to all the agents within the area so everyone could be on the same page. Unfortunately, Bud and Lou sneak into the office. They steal all the apples, and they do the routine 20 and 22. As they split up 40 apples, Bud says, "Okay, you've got 20 and I've got 22. And Bud's like, "No, wait a minute. Why do you have 22 and I only have..." No, don't you understand? And then he reverses it. And he says, "Okay, so how many do you have?" And he goes, "Well, you have 20 and I have 22. And he ends up giving the extra one to Abbott. And Abbott accepts it, of course, you know.
Of course.
But then when they bite into them, they realize that they are phony and they start throwing them, you know, behind them. They just start haphazardly throwing them. And it just so happens that a string of donkeys eat the apples. So they've got these radio receivers in their tummies. And a dog, a beautiful German Shepherd.
Yes.
So well behaved, such a great dog. He eats one too. And that comes in later. One of the funniest scenes in the movie. So, Barry Nelson. Now, Barry Nelson was kind of not an A-list actor, but he played leads. And I remember him on television playing leads, you know, in series and stuff like that. He plays a double agent. He's working with the Nazis, but he's actually on our side. So that comes into it later. So this big festival is happening this weekend. And this is why Ricardo is going back to his hometown, to this Vista del Costanza. And and they're having a big radio broadcast at the fiesta. So the Nazis plan on giving messages, coded messages, to the Nazis that have these apples, the receivers, and they'll get the special message. You know, it almost sounds childish in a way. You know, it's like the Ovaltine ring. You know, the secret code.
You would give me my Ovaltine, yeah.
So these Nazis are, you know, it's not exactly brain surgery. Okay, I do want to say that there is one song number that I mentioned earlier, that the only songs I can get through, and I'm going to recommend this to our listeners if you're going to watch Rio Rita, and it is available on disc from Warner Archive, by by the way. There are no extras or anything. It's just, you know, what is it? MOD? Made on demand.
Made on demand, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a great print, and it's really a nice way to watch it. So this song number, it kind of reminds me of I'll Remember April, if you remember back to Ride'em Cowboy. Mm-hmm. It was like a midnight ride, and it was very dreamy, and, you know, the moonlight and all that stuff. This is during the day, and it is the two of them riding. And at one point, she's got a record player, a portable record player. And she's off in the mountains, and she's listening to Ricardo sing on the record, and he sneaks up behind her, and he sings Rio Rita.
Rio Rita, life is sweeter, Rita, when you are near. Rio Rita.
Rio Rita, la 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 la. And that's very pretty. And then the Rangers show up, and that's about, it's MGM. So there's like 3,000 Rangers on hookup. and of course they all sing beautifully and harmonize, and they do the Ranger song. Which is a lot of fun. It's very rousing, and the way the number is filmed, I have to say, I really enjoy it. It's the only musical number in this movie that I enjoy. And when they're riding and singing at the same time, there's a medium shot of John Carroll, who is actually doing his own riding. And I mean, it's real. It's real riding. It's galloping with these guys. So anyway, that's a really nice moment. And I wish they would have cut out the rest of the songs because not one of them comes close. Not even the one by Harburg and Arlen. Okay, so also amongst the Nazis is an actor by the name of Arthur Space. Now, Arthur Space, if you are a fan of Laurel and Hardy, he played the eccentric scientist or inventor in The Big mm-hmm. Noise, which is a film that has come under scrutiny because we grew up reading William K. Everson's book about Laurel and Hardy.
Oh, yes.
And he just said it was one of the worst movies ever made and blah, blah, blah. And we grew up believing that. And
of course.
Lately, you watch it, it's not a bad movie at all.
It's not.
It's actually a lot of fun. So it's nice that came about.
And speaking of that film, if I'm remembering it correctly, also includes a brief appearance by Margaret Dumont.
That would be Dancing Masters.
Was it?
Mm-hmm. She played, what's her name? Sheila Ryan's mother in that.
We'll cut this out.
Smart makes me look smart.
Yeah.
Okay, so Rita actually takes a liking to Bud and Lou. And much like Johnny Mack Brown in the last movie in Ride'em Cowboy, mm-hmm. they're looking for work, and she's nice enough to give them jobs as house detectives at the resort. And then they see what the situation is. Now, this is where Abbott and Costello transcend maybe the comedy relief stuff that they'd been experiencing, you know, of late, because they get involved now with Rita, and they want to help Rita get together with Ricardo and get Lucette out of the picture. And Lucette, it's revealed later, is also a double agent. Everybody thinks she's working with the Nazis, but she is not. But anyway, at this point, we don't know that. And Bud tells Lou he has to make love to Lucette. He has to take Lucette away from 6'2", handsome, mustachioed John Carroll. This 5'5", 239-pound. Yeah, little Lou Costello. So he has to do that. He has to make love to her. He says to him, you know, take her out dancing. You know? And he says, yeah, there's only one dance I do. That's the elevator dance. The elevator dance? Yeah, no steps. Now, Three Stooges fans will know that from their vaudeville act with Ted Healy back in the 1920s. So that joke was trotted out for the boys. Oh, he also does that joke about Bud says, well, haven't you ever been in love? And he says, yeah, I was in love once.
Once?
Yeah, yeah. She was a bow-legged cowgirl. And what happened? Well, you know, she just couldn't get her calves together. I mean, awful, just awful, but wonderful.
You know, there are some brilliant comedy moments in this movie, and those aren't some of them.
But this is where Bud, they're walking along, you know, the hotel, and Lou is like peeking into keyholes and, you know, paying the price. But, and then Bud all of a sudden opens one of the doors, and there's this beautiful blonde, and she summons Bud into the room, and Bud goes into the room and closes the door. And that's the last we see of Bud. He's up in the trap at one point. But, you know, Bud's getting some action in MGM. Yeah. And it's not, you know, Louis B. Mayer's chicken soup. So, you know, I kind of like that. I kind of like that Bud got a little action there. And speaking of a little action, I'm going to take another little side trip here.
Okay.
This is the movie where they came to the decision to split the salary 60-40. 60 for Lou, 40 for Bud. And here's the story. There are two stories behind it. The first story I heard is that when their manager, Eddie Sherman, told them, you've got to get out of burlesque, and I'm going to put you into the Steel Pier in Atlantic City, and we're going to start, you know, building you up. Bud, who had been in burlesque since he was a teen, was trepidatious about it. And he said, I'll tell you what, I'll do it if you give me $10 more a week than Lou is getting. And Lou wanted to do this so badly that he said, take it out of my salary. And Bud took the extra 10 and Lou lost 10.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing, and the one that's more believable in my estimation, was that in burlesque, straight men got 60% of the salary, just as a rule, because straight men were more dear. They were more, they were less in abundance. So Lou had to do that once they teamed up, and it continued up until Lou finally said, whoa, wait a minute. You know,
yeah. Did that also have something to do with the fact that many times the straight man was also like the manager of the act, the booker, the, you know, made the travel arrangements, that sort of thing?
I never heard that before. Although that would have worked with Bud and Lou because that was Bud's business, you know, before he became a performer. Here's my thought on this, and I write about this in the book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello.
Available where all fine books are sold.
Right. Or the places where they sell ours. But see, you know, I say something and then I knock it out of my head when I was talking about it. And it drives me crazy. Oh, we're talking about 60-40.
60-40, yeah.
Right. So Lou finally said, you know what? I've had enough of this. I want 60% now. And Bud will have to take 40. And that's that. And he left no room for negotiation. Bud had to do it or break up the act. Yeah. Now, my thought is, I think it's fair. In fact, I think it's more than fair. Lou worked twice as hard as Bud did. Yeah. Lou was on the schedule for more days with each movie. He was more physically active and exhausted by the end of the day. How many times we talked about this where Bud would say, all right, I've got to go do this thing over here. Why don't you do this over there? And Lou would work for 10, 15 minutes with somebody else. So in the same way that Stan Laurel got more money than Oliver Hardy because he worked more hours, you know, he was on the creative team. Ollie went home and he didn't mind at all. So this is what happened. This is Lou finally said, what's going on here? You know, I'm working twice as hard as this guy and I'm still making 40%. So anyway, that's the other story. I'm sure the truth is somewhere in the middle, but that's what happened during this film. And that was actually the first real rift between the two of them, you know, and it's understandable. Like I could see, you know, money among friends, forget it. So that was an uncomfortable situation during the making of this film. Okay, so they are now house detectives. They are detectives in a house where Nazis are trying to get messages to their cohorts. so they can sabotage our, you know, forts and our movie theaters showing this movie and Universal films. So one of the funniest scenes in the movie comes up at this point, where Bud is off with his blonde and Lou sits down next to the German shepherd that swallowed the apple earlier. And they get into a conversation, and it is just so funny. Lou is dying to find out how the Brooklyn Dodgers are doing, you know?
Yeah.
And of course the sports report comes on the radio, the apple, and it creates a whole scene. And it's a very funny scene.
I don't know nothing. I'd have been better off if I asked you to score.
There was some ball game in Brooklyn today.
There was?
A wild and woolly slugfest.
Who won the game?
The Brooklyn Dodgers beat the Cincinnati Reds.
What do you know? How do you like that? And that guy over there, he... Oh, yeah? Brooklyn win, huh? What do you know? Who was a pinch hitter? Never mind. Never mind. Don't tell me. Hey, Wishy.
Come here, I've got some great news for you. I'm taking Dottie out to lunch. Lend me a couple of dollars, will you?
Not me, I'm broke.
Oh, come on, you must have a couple of dollars.
I ain't got any money, I tell you, I'm broke.
You're a house detective. Someone must have slipped you a couple of dollars.
Nobody slipped me nothing, because I ain't got no money.
All right.
Would you like to borrow some money?
Yes, I'd like to borrow. That's what I want to do. I want to borrow a couple of dollars.
Hey, Doc, it ain't me. It's a dog. The dog talks.
Now, wait a minute. Just a minute.
I never saw anything like it.
Just a minute.
I'm baffled.
Listen to me. You just asked me if I wanted to borrow a couple of dollars, didn't you?
That wasn't me, kid.
But I want to borrow a couple of dollars. If you got it or
I had some money, I'd give it to you. I ain't got it.
All right. Keep the remarks to yourself.
How much do you want to borrow?
You get me in an awful lot of trouble here, kid, with my friend.
Now, listen. Are you trying to kid me? I said I want to borrow a couple of dollars.
See the trouble you're getting me into.
What are you trying to do? What is this all about?
Doc, if I had some money, I'd give it to you.
You had it, I wouldn't take it. I wouldn't take $100 off you.
You can borrow $300.
I'd cut it out, kid. Would you cut it out?
No. Now, listen. No, I won't take no more of that off you. Do you understand? No more of that off you.
Get
him. Now, stand still.
Yeah, my head.
Never mind your head. No remarks. I don't want to talk to you again.
Write me a letter.
Right. Will you cut it out? Will you cut it out?
I'll write you a letter. What is it?
Doc, I'm telling you, the dog. The dog.
What dog?
I'm telling you, he befuddles me. The dog talks.
He what?
He talks. Watch.
Are you kidding?
No, he gave me the baseball score before. Watch this. Go ahead, say something, dog. Come on. Go ahead.
There are honest finance companies. Don't be taken in by phonies. Everyone knows there's no such thing as a talking dog.
How do you like that? Just when I want him to say something, he won't say nothing.
Yeah.
Station KBKO, El Paso.
All right. So here's something interesting.
Yes.
They do another one of their standby routines, which is guessing the number. So Arthur Space, this is Carnival. It's Fiesta. So it's a game where there are 10 girls lined up. They all have numbers around their necks. And the person has to turn their backs while the other person kisses one of the girls, and the guy has to guess which number he kissed. And it just gets all crazy and convoluted. And of course, at the very end, he kisses a zero, and Lou doesn't know how to translate this to Bud and whatever. I'm not explaining it very well, but it is one of the comedy highlights.
It's
one of their John Grant official, you know, burlesque routines. But the interesting thing is, this very morning, I turned on YouTube and there was a Vitaphone Ben Blue short subject from 1934, co-starring Shemp Howard. And they do this routine, the number routine.
Wow.
1934. So I'm sure it's something that was done all through the 1920s, possibly the 10s. And here are Bud and Lou doing it at MGM in a major A picture.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that's kind of cool. So they end up winning the contest. And part of their winnings is this bottle of booze. It's this very, very strong bottle of booze. Now, this is the one scene that they took from the original Rio Rita, and it was the best scene that Wheeler and Woolsey did. And what happens is, this booze that they win, Lou takes a little drink of it. Well, one of my favorite Bud Abbott moments, you know, go ahead and drink it. You know, it could be poison. Go ahead. What are you worried about? it's like he's not human, you know?
Yeah.
So Lou takes a drink. And not only does his hat fly off his head, He sees an owl that isn't there, but then he sees a woman, and the woman starts taking off her clothes. And Bud says, "What are you looking at?" And she goes, "Oh, I'm afraid to tell you. She's taking off her clothes." And Bud said, "Give me a drink of that." Okay, so that's the punchline. And it's the same punchline as Wheeler and Woolsey had in 1929. Yep.
This scene also contained my other favorite visual in the film. Of course, Lou uncorks the bottle and, you know, steam is shooting all over the place.
Yeah.
He tries to pour some into a glass that's on the desk, and the glass melts.
Right in front of our eyes. You know?
Yes, it was beautifully done.
And you got to say, that had to be made of ice, you know, the glass. And then they poured boiling water on it, you know. It's brilliant. It really is brilliant.
Yeah. It just looks gorgeous.
So they do that, and that scene is one of two highlights that are featured in Robert Youngson's MGM's Big Parade of Comedy. They have two sequences from this film. I know, MGM of all people.
You know, I'm sorry, but MGM's Big Parade of Comedy sounds like it'd be a two-reeler. You know, there's not all that much material.
If it's a parade, a two-wheeler, you know. It's
just, hey, there you go.
There you go. I figured I'd float that a lot. This is bad to me.
Today?
That reminds me. I received a clip from the Goodson Todman people. Do you believe that they are fans of this podcast?
Really?
Yes. From the game show, you know, Dynasty. They are big fans of this podcast. And they have a clip from one of their TV shows that features Bud Abbott. And this is after Lou passed away. And Bud was the mystery guest. And I think I could, let me just put this on here and we'll go with this. Here we go. Now, if the panel has their blindfolds on, we'll start with Bennett Cerf.
Well, John, the applause that I heard was quite copious, and I'm thinking, are you in show business?
Of course I'm in show business. What are you, some kind of a nut? Talk sense. What are you? That cockamamie Random House. It's terrible. It's dead. It should be Random Hearse. It's terrible.
All right. Dorothy Kilgallen.
Tell me, have we had lunch together at 21?
I don't know what age we were. Who knows? Why don't you go interview Jack Ruby and leave me alone? Get out of here! What are you, crazy? Go at it! And while you're there, buy yourself a chin.
Marlene Francis.
Are you Bud Abbott?
And that's all there is. That's it. I don't think he was ever invited back.
I would hope not.
Yeah, but that last clap knocked Arlene Francis's heart pendant, her necklace, right off her. It went slung and hit Dorothy Cabana where her chin should be. In fact, Bud kept framed on his wall for years a congratulatory telegram from Frank Sinatra for making fun of Dorothy Kilgallen. He was very proud of that. It was right next to his record of who's on first.
Oh, my God.
So anyway, I'd like to thank the Goodman's Hodgman people.
You go ahead and thank them. Yes, you go right ahead.
Okay. The hilarity continues. So let's get to the big washing machine scene.
Yes.
Now this is the other scene that Robert Youngson chose to lighten our lives with, and it actually is a funny scene. It's a good one. Lou, they're being chased, of course, and Lou hides in a laundry bin, and Norman Abbott, Bud's nephew, shows up. He's the laundry guy. And he ends up dumping the laundry down the chute, of course, and into this enormous washing machine type thing. Now, I wrote down the name of it because it's MGM. It wouldn't be a typical washing machine name. MGM just can't have a normal washing machine. It's got to be the Colossus automated washer. And of course it is. And it is that. It does describe it. It's enormous. You could a family could live in it. And and they'd be
and
very
wash clean. Their clothes at the same time.
And of course Bud uses the old trope, what are you doing? It's not Saturday night. You know, these comedians only took baths on Saturday night.
Yeah,
that's one of those jokes like post office. That's a kid's game. Not the way I play it. The joke just keeps coming back and coming back like a bad meal. So, OK, so this Lou ends up in this enormous washing machine. Bud, of course, tries to help him out and steps on the wrong button. And it starts spinning as fast as the car did earlier. on the precipice. And Lou, once Bud hits the brake, Lou goes flying out. He's on wires, of course, and it's not him. Mm-hmm. It's his brother, Pat Costello. Yeah, who claimed he was almost suffocated shooting this scene. When the wet sheet falls on his head and whatever. It's a messy scene. But anyway, Lou goes flying out of the thing and he lands with his head through the wall. And Bud comes over and pulls his head out of the wall. And he's not concerned about Lou at all. He's, look what you did to the man's wall. which is why we love Bud so much.
Yeah.
So anyway, the chase continues. Bud and Lou are captured. They are tied up by the Nazis. Jake, my favorite of the Nazis. Peter Whitney, by the way. I don't know if you're a fan of a movie called Murder, He Says.
Yes.
With Fred McMurray and Marjorie Main. Mm-hmm. Peter Whitney plays the twins. Mert and Bert, I think their names are. And he's hilarious. And he's just as good in this movie. He's terrific. He's a great foil.
Yeah.
So anyway, he leaves Abbott and Costello in a room with a bomb, a time bomb. And it's set to go off at 11:25. Somehow they get out. I think John Carroll comes and saves them, blah, blah, blah. The chase continues. This is funny. Lou slips the bomb into Jake's back pocket without him knowing it, right? And Jake doesn't know it's there, so he keeps showing up. And Lou's like, no, no, get away from us. It's just a whole thing about staying away from Jake because he's got the bomb. So the Nazis realize that everything's going wrong. They get in a car and they drive away. And Jake is running after them because they leave him behind. And Lou yells, wait for Jake. And he jumps onto the running board. They turn the corner and you hear an explosion. So everybody's dead.
Yep.
And Lou looks right at the camera, looks at his watch and says, 11:25. Good night, folks. And that's the end. There are limbs around that corner, you know, just
what better way to end a comedy than blowing up a car full of people? You know, it's just
at least they were Nazis, you know.
True.
No great.
That's true.
But do you know that wasn't the original ending?
I'm not surprised.
Just trivia out the wazoo, this episode. Actually, it's a very convoluted joke that I'm glad they didn't use because it's just so, I don't know, it's too strenuous.
Okay.
Lou is, he's talking on the microphone and you see the Nazis listening, you know, for their message.
Yeah.
And Lou says, here's your secret message. It has to do with your inkwell. And the Nazis look down at the inkwell on their desks and they pick it up. He said, okay, now take the inkwell and now take a piece of ice and put it in the inkwell. And he put it in the inkwell and he says, now tell me what you see. And they all kind of say, iced ink. And Lou says, you're telling me. And that's the end. It's a little convoluted, I would say.
Yeah, blowing them up was definitely a better ending. Yeah.
Well, you know, the Nazis.
But yes, that moment just when Lou yells out, wait for Jake, that I was on the floor. That was great.
It was funny. It really was. But you know, you look at it now. I look at this movie and I think it's got all the pitfalls of a MGM comedy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They try to put like operatic numbers. I remember when I was a kid in New York, on Saturday nights, they would show like three MGM musicals, mostly from the 40s and 50s. And I had never seen these movies, so I'm seeing them for the first time. And I'm realizing what MGM is. They are trying to educate as well as entertain. which is kind of why their movies are a little stodgy and, you know, whatever. Lawrence Melchior, the opera singer, became like a regular in their musicals. So you always had to sit still for, you know, opera. Catherine Grayson was a big star. So you had to put up with the, again, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was MGM. That's what they sold. That was their product. It wasn't Abbott and Costello, that's for sure. And by the time they got to their third film with MGM, like I said, they did one every year.
Yeah.
MGM was ready to part company at that point. It was not a happy marriage. They were more comfortable at Universal.
I do want to say two things, first of all.
Yes.
This recent viewing of the film, it's probably the one I have seen the least of all of their movies.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see it for the first time till like 5 years ago, maybe.
What was your impression as an adult, as a performer, seeing it, you know, just 5 years ago?
Pretty much what we've covered. The fact that here they are now at MGM, their first MGM movie, big budgets, et cetera, et cetera. But their names come first. However, they're we got a help of those kids. I mean, you know, it was that sort of. In fact, Lou even says, you know, Rita, we need to help Rita.
Oh, yeah.
Very much a supporting role. Mm-hmm. And that hit me right off the bat. Also, the diversity of the comedy and the not comedy. Their scenes just jumped off the screen. Mm-hmm. They were so good, especially compared to everything else that's in the movie. So there was that. Then one of my favorite jokes in the whole film. We haven't touched on it yet. There's a point where Lou gets backed up into a cactus. And it's the whatever you could, it's not a leaf, but, you know, the part of the cactus, you know, tears away from the main branch and it's stuck on his butt. And he finally takes it off. And of course, Abbott says, "What are you doing with that thing? Put it back where you found it." "What?" "Put it back where you found it." "Okay." And he sticks it back on his butt.
I love that too. So oh my God. And then there's some dated jokes in this one, more so than the Universal films. There's one where they're trying to bribe Lou with something and he'd say, "I wouldn't even take a good tire," or something like that. You know,
the
rubber was so dear. And then there was another reference to sugar, a lump of sugar, which was another
little pouch thing. You know, hold on to this, is very important. What is it? 2 cubes of sugar, you know.
2 cubes of sugar, that's it. So yeah, you had your wartime stuff that wasn't quite developed yet at Universal. You know, you had your pre-war stuff, but this was the first really where they referenced actually being in the war. You know, isn't that interesting? Because they made, what, those 6 movies for Universal, and it was all about preparation at that point.
Yeah.
And in this one, we are full out against the Nazis, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And let's talk about Tom Conway a little bit. I thought he was terrific in this movie.
Yes.
He's got a great dry delivery. He's sinister. He's just, just sinister. He's got that great George Sanders type voice, you know?
I was just going to say, it kind of ran in the family. You could tell.
Yeah, definitely. You know? Oh, no, it's seeped in the family. It oozed in the film. And George Sanders is in my top 10 favorite actors. So Tom wasn't quite there. But
George Sanders, my gosh, I followed his career in reverse because my first exposures to him were Mr. Freeze on Batman.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Shere Khan in the Disney Jungle Book.
Shere Khan.
And it's like, I love this guy. What else has he done? You know, let's go backwards from here.
Even as a child, I was so taken by this guy and what he could do and that voice. Oh, my God. Whether he was playing a villain or a cat or whatever he was, he's just one of my all-time favorites. There was something else. Oh, and to Tom Conway. Neither one of them ended up well. George Sanders ended up famously committing suicide.
Yeah.
But Tom ended up a hopeless alcoholic living in a Skid Row motel, you know, horrible, just horrible.
Wow.
Alcohol. It's the worst. It's the absolute worst. You know, I don't drink. I don't drink. I don't like to drink. Are you listening to me, folks? Don't drink. Drinking sucks. Don't drink. Okay. Look what it did to Bud drank.
And then exactly.
He got fatter than Lou.
I'm fatter than Lou.
So anyway, I will tell people that I did a one-act play over Zoom where I played both Bud and Lou. And that if you could have seen that, it would have been probably even more entertaining than hearing it. Just the facial expressions change, you know, every time. You can't do it without doing that. You have to be stern looking for Bud and innocent looking for Lou. So,
well, you know, voice acting is just as all inclusive. I mean, you can't get a good sound unless your whole body is in it. You know, you absolutely watch some of these, like, you know, voiceover artists, or you and I both have done audiobooks as well. It's a physical workout in addition to a vocal workout.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would sweat after doing a book, you know,
yeah,
after working 8 hours reading chapters. And I mm-hmm. wouldn't read the books ahead of time. I took it all as new.
You're a braver man than I am.
here we are talking about ourselves. I'm sorry. But when I was a kid, I used to read out loud into the tape recorder.
Mm.
Just to hear if I could do it without making mistakes and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then my friends and I eventually, not only did we make movies, you know, like 8mm and Super 8mm, but we made tapes. We made comedy tapes. And I usually played about 80 characters in these things. And it trained me for later in life.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. You and I were destined to get together at some point. You know, you just told my life story.
I feel like every time I say something about, you know, my past or what I think, you know, I'm looking at you and you're nodding, or I see the recognition in your eyes, you know? So we're definitely brothers from another mother's smothers or something along those lines.
And she always liked you best. Okay,
kiddo. This was a lot of fun. And it's interesting because this was a movie that neither one of us is super familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, it didn't show up on TV very often at all.
Yeah.
So I thought we covered it pretty well at this point.
So I
hope
think so.
You seek it out, folks. And we will next week. We'll be looking at...
Well, next 2 weeks.
In the next 2 weeks. That's right. We are stepping up our recording schedule.
Yes.
And the next episode, episode 9, is about one of my top 5. And a lot of people don't agree with me, so it's going to be interesting. But Pardon My Sarong is next. And I think it's one of their funniest movies.
You know, they say conflict makes good drama. And I wish I could offer you some conflict on that decision, but no, it's one of my tops of theirs as well.
It's just so funny. It's such a goofy movie. Oh my God.
Yes.
Everything about it is just hilarious. It's like they got it right with Pardon My Sarong.
Yep.
So that's the one we'll be looking at next. And I look forward to seeing you again, Jerry, and making more magic with you. You take care. And we will get together for another one of these go rounds.
Indeed. I always look forward to these. As much as I have to listen to the Bud Abbott variety show, I still enjoy our time together. I'm so glad we had this time together.
Okay. Well, maybe next week we won't have a Bud Abbott. Now we're going to have all these letters come in. And what about the Bud Abbott? But anyway, Jerry.
Anyway.
Good care of yourself and everybody else. Please stay safe, stay happy, and stay put. I don't know why that last one. I think it just came out. I sound like my mother at my birthday. It just came out. That's what I'm going to end on. Bye, everybody.
Oh, God.